The Lara Murphy Show, episode 62.
Welcome to The Lara Murphy Show, the podcast that analyzes financial markets from the perspective of Austrian economics and Nelson Nash's infinite banking concept. Listen and learn as your hosts, Robert Murphy and Carlos Lara, explain how you can be part of building the 10%.
Welcome, everyone, to another episode of the Lara Murphy Show. Carlos, how are things in Nashville?
Hi, Bob. They're great in Nashville. Great weather. Just super.
One of these days, one of these episodes, I want to ask you, and I want you to say it's absolutely atrocious. The zoo had a breakout. There's lions mauling people as we speak. It'd be more exciting. So, folks, before we get into this episode, let me remind you that Carlos and I and David Stearns are going to be in Dallas-Fort Worth area on Saturday, October 13th, and we're in 2018, for another IBC seminar designed for the general public. So again, this is a thing where we don't assume any background knowledge. So if you've just been catching the episodes here or there and you're just curious, you want to know more, this is for you. But also we go into things in very great depth because we have you for a while. It's from 10 a.m. to 3 p.m. And so we cover the whole gamut from the beginner to expert topics. So if you're at all interested in IBC, and also there's some Austrian economics there where we give you the state of the economy from an Austrian perspective and show you why IBC is all the more relevant given our current situation. So for the details on how to register for that seminar, again, that's going to be in Fort Worth on Saturday, October 13th. Go to ibcseminar.com. Now, the topic for today's podcast episode was actually somebody on Twitter recommended this. And basically, let me summarize it by saying the guy said, okay, I get IBC. It sounds like an interesting concept. I've been studying it. But basically, you need to have previously saved some wealth and then you have it in the form of this dividend paying whole life policy. And then when you want to go buy something, you borrow against that. You take out a policy loan and you're borrowing against that asset and the life insurance company gives you some money and then you use that to go consummate the purchase. And so the guy asks, why is that any better than just, quote, paying cash for something? All right, so that's his question. And it's a good question. And I think it'll be useful for you listeners if Carlos and I walk through that and take a shot at answering his question. First of all, to answer it directly, but also along the way that I think it'll just shed more light on how does IBC work and what's the rationale. So let me, my first immediate response is just to point out that when you're, quote, paying cash for something, what does that mean? It's saying that you're going to build up savings somehow, you know, earmarked for some purchase. So let's just say you got to want to buy something that costs $1,000. And so to pay cash means, oh, you're going to first accumulate the $1,000 in wealth and then go buy it. Now, one way of doing that is out of every paycheck, you could set aside $50 a week or something. And then after 20 weeks, you'd have $1,000 if you were like literally keeping it as currency under your mattress. But that's not what most people would do, especially if we're talking about a longer term thing like, you know, every time you buy a new car, did you have a sinking fund set up where you build the thing up over time such that up when it's time to get a new car, you have enough saved up in this vehicle, you know, this investment vehicle in order to, you know, get your trade in and cover the difference for the new car. Okay, so that's what people have in mind. And I'm saying typically because of price inflation and because of positive market rates of interest, you would be silly in most cases to literally be storing cash under your mattress, certainly not since we went off the gold standard. And so given that, I'm going to say, okay, well, where are you going to accumulate this sinking? Where are you going to store your cash? And you might have thought, oh, commercial bank, that's a pretty safe place. But as we go through in chapter one of our book, The Case for IBC, which is thecaseforibc.com, that's actually not so safe anymore. Plus, they pay very paltry rates of interest. On the other hand, you might put it in the stock market and get a decent return, but we think that that's also a very risky thing to do. And so even, you know, forget IBC for the moment, just this very pedestrian standard finance risk-reward analysis, accumulating your savings in a dividend-paying whole life policy is actually a pretty conservative, reasonable thing to do. that it's a good asset, even on its own terms, just for its various attributes. All right. So that's the, you know, one thing I would say is if you're thinking about, quote, paying cash for things, really what you mean is you're accumulating your wealth in some particular investment vehicle. And so even just at that superficial level of analysis, storing it in a dividend paying whole life policy is pretty reasonable, especially when you take into account all the tax considerations. So don't worry, folks, we're going to get into more of IBC specific answers as this episode progresses. But I did want to just make that point. Even if you never heard of IBC, it wouldn't be crazy for you to do things this way. You want to respond at this point, Carlos? I've been monopolizing the conversation.
Well, again, I think what we're doing at this point is more or less setting the table, you know, for everyone on what it is that we're going to be discussing, because what this individual did when he tweeted out that message, it really makes a lot of sense. It's this whole idea is why is it that we hear for those people that are advocating IBC that, you know, you should take out a policy loan to pay or purchase something? Why is that beneficial, you know, over just simply paying cash for it? If you're brand new to IBC, you may take the side of the individual that tweeted that message, because it just only makes sense. If you're sitting there with the cash, you know, why not go ahead and just pay for it? What's all this good stuff about taking out a policy loan? Because isn't taking out a policy loan, isn't it a debt? I mean, because you're getting the money from the life insurance company, and what you're giving up is a collateral interest on the amount that you're going to borrow, you know, if you have that in cash value. And then on top of that, you're going to be paying interest on it because it is a loan. So why would I want to bring on debt to myself plus interest? If I'm sitting there with the cash, why not go ahead and just pay cash for it? That's really the nature of the question. And it's, as you said, Bob, it's a good question. Now, we have to talk about some of the things surrounding all of that. And I'll just mention this part on my behalf right now, I'm trying to set the table again, is that I believe the view on this may be taken differently if you are a person that basically receives a paycheck from an establishment where you work, in the sense you're an employee of an establishment, as opposed to someone that operates a business. A business owner understands the idea of borrowing money, you know, from a commercial bank, because it allows them more use of money, you know, to do more things with than to use up his actual, you know, real working capital that he has in his bank. In other words, by taking out loans from a commercial bank, you get, you know, more cash coming into your business to buy and operate for other. Now, he realizes he has to pay interest on those loans, and he realizes there's a risk involved in that. But being a business owner, he's telling himself, I'm going to manage all this, and I don't want to tap my own money. I want to utilize the services of a commercial bank in order to access more money to be able to do more things. So we have these two views that could arise in answering this question. If you're an employee, you're going to see it on a very basic level of, if I've got cash sitting in the bank, you know, why not just pay for this thing that I'm wanting to buy or pay for? Why take on debt? But from a business owner standpoint, when we get around to answering some of the reasons why you would want to do this, the business owner may tune into this and say, oh, yeah, I get this because I do this in my business all the time. So all I've done here, Bob, is just, again, make sure that we're setting the table correctly for what we're going to be discussing. And so I hope that kind of helps in now setting the stage for some of the things that you want to say about all that and what I will say about it.
Okay, sure. And so just to make sure people aren't getting lost, because again, we have listeners who are coming at this from various levels of expertise or personal experience. And as Carlos says, there can be a big difference in mindset between like a wage or salaried employee who they just get a fixed amount every 2 weeks or whatever it is versus a business owner who's got a lot of money coming and going and revenue streams are, you know, seasonal and things like that. So what Carlos is getting at there is a business owner who has money in the business's checking account and needs to pay for something might elect to keep that money in the checking account. And like, for example, if the commercial bank has a line of credit, might rely on that. All right. And so, you know, that's, and of course, in the case for IBC, we get into why we think the business owner should wean himself off of that approach and start using instead properly constructed dividend paying whole life policies. But the point being, this notion that, oh, you might, even if you had the money on you, you might not necessarily want to use that to buy something. You might instead want to, quote, finance it. That's not a crazy idea. That's not something peculiar to IBC. IBC is really just talking about the way you, quote, finance your purchases. Okay, so let me come at this from a certain angle and put it in stark terms. And I've had some people do this when they say, wait a minute. They're saying, Bob, you're telling me, let's say I've got $1,000 in cash, like literally in my hands or in my checking account, and there's something that costs $1,000 that I'm going to buy, right? So the issue is not, do I want to buy it or not? The issue is I am going to buy it. It's $1,000. I have $1,000 in my checking account. And Murphy, are you telling me, rather than just use my debit card or write a check and buy the thing, and I directly just pay the merchant, and so my checking account balance goes down by $1,000 and I acquire whatever the object is and that's it. You're saying, or are you saying, Murphy, instead I should take that $1,000 and make an additional, what's called a PUA, paid up additional contribution into my properly structured dividend paying whole life policy, and then borrow against that policy to get the $1,000 and pay the merchant? So this is a big question, and I don't want to give a blanket answer. There's a lot of variables, but in general, I would say yes, that if you had room, like this is me saying what I do in my situation, and I have done this, right? This is, so I'm not just making airy prognostications or recommendations. This is something that I would follow myself, is that yes, if in a year where I still have extra room to make contributions to my IBC policy, then I would do that, right? If I have something I'm going to buy and I have the cash, I would first detour or route it through the policy in order to try to fund the policy as much as I can for that particular year. Because there's various, we can't get into it now, it's too complex, but we spell it out in our book. There's various reasons that, you know, for a given policy with its design and so forth, you can only contribute so much into it before it loses its special, the full beneficial treatment in terms of tax and regulatory issues. Okay, so I would do that. Now, let me just mention here, because there's a lot of confusion on this topic. Even though I agree that's a good thing to do, I have seen people who are fans of IBC try to explain the rationale behind that, where, no, rather than paying cash for something, if you've got the cash literally on you, maybe first you should put it in your policy, let the dust settle, then borrow against it and do it that way. I have seen some people, they bring in what they refer to as lost opportunity cost. And let me just, again, I agree with the overall conclusion, but sometimes I think I've seen people make an argument that's a little bit off, or it's not that it's off, but they're leaving something out and they might be misleading the listener unintentionally. So let me just clarify where I come down on this issue. Is that the way you might hear someone explain it is to say, okay, when you pay for something with cash, that's it. The transaction's over, and now you no longer have any opportunity to earn interest on that $1,000. So that's gone forever. And, you know, now here I, Bob Murphy, am saying, yep, that's a true statement. And it's also true, if instead of buying that thing, you took the $1,000 and put it in your IBC policy, now you're going to earn more dividends and, you know, increase in cash value over time than you otherwise would have had you not made that extra contribution of the $1,000. That's also a true statement. And that even grows exponentially over time, right? So the ramifications, your decision to spend the $1,000 buying whatever the object was, let's say it's a, you know, fancy TV or something, versus putting it in your IBC policy, the consequences of that choice grow over time in terms of spot market value. Right? It's exponential. If you had put it in the policy, it would be growing over time. But the thing is, if we've said at the outset that there's no question you're buying that thing for $1,000 right then, it's not that the question is, huh, should I maybe wait and save and wait a little bit? If the issue is you're buying it one way or the other, and then what's the way, what do you, should you do with your money first? When you put it in, yeah, your policy's growing now, but you then have to take out that $1,000 policy loan, right? Because again, by assumption, we're saying you are buying that object either way, regardless of whether you do the IBC approach or not. And so, yes, even though your policy is now growing, you know, it jumped up in value. And so now as it rolls over exponentially, it's a bigger and bigger thing, a bigger and bigger asset. On the flip side, that policy loan is now, you know, whatever your balance was before you made the decision, now the balance was $1,000 higher. And then that is rolling over at interest because the policy loan grows exponentially too. Okay. So I'm just saying, make sure when you're thinking this thing through, you realize that flip side of it. So because that's, you know, that's a cost of the decision that wouldn't be there if you just, quote, paid cash for the thing, that you wouldn't, your policy loan wouldn't, balance wouldn't jump up either. So, you know, if we, in a simplest scenario, if we assume the interest rates were roughly the same, in other words, the amount that you're earning on your policy through dividends and this, the standard guarantees of the cash value and whatnot, if that was roughly the same as the policy loan interest rate, then it would be a wash if that was the only thing you considered. So now why do I like going the IBC route? Because you could, you know, again, you could think, oh, it's a matter of, it's a wash or something. The reason I don't want to do the pay cash, and I think there is an important psychological benefit of this whole, you know, exponential growth thing, is that when you pay cash, you know, you buy that fancy TV for $1,000 and the sound system or whatever for $1,000, yeah, that's gone forever and you forget about that. You just go on with your life and you've got the nice consumer products and that's it. Whereas if you do it the IBC way, every time you get a statement from the life insurance company showing you your policy, you're going to see that policy loan balance growing because now it's higher because you borrowed $1,000. And so I think psychologically, you're going to be more motivated to save more, to watch your spending down the road in order to chip away at that policy loan balance, because you know you've got that nice, big, fat, gross cash value sitting there as an asset that has this lien against it. And so if you could just knock out that lien, then you'd have full access to the cash value. Okay, so again, if you were a robot and people didn't have emotions and they were perfectly logical and, you know, Mr. Spock was designing your financial plan, in principle, this sort of thing wouldn't matter, but I'm thinking with real human beings and how they are, I actually think over time it would make you more conscious of your spending because you would see, oh, if I could just watch, you know, if we could just watch our budget and chip away at this policy loan over time, we'd have this nice big fat cash value sitting there waiting for us. Whereas if you take the $1,000 and just doop, give it to Best Buy and that's it, 10 years down the road, you're going to think, oh, wow, man, imagine how much that $1,000 would have been worth right now if we had just watched our spending in the meantime. No, it's just, that's gone. You don't even think about it anymore. So anyway, that may have been a little bit too laborious for some of you, but again, I wanted to be crystal clear. There is a huge element of truth in this idea of you're missing the lost opportunity cost, but I do want to make sure people realize, make sure you always keep track of the policy loans too, that it's not money for nothing. But given human nature, I still do think it makes sense, all things considered, to try to get these IBC policies to be as big as you can, given what your income is.
Yeah, I really like that, Bob. That made a lot of sense. It's good, especially on that lost opportunity cost thing that we hear a lot about. So let me see if I can explain this from a different angle altogether. And here I'm going to say again, in much the same way that I spoke about a previous LMR article that I wrote called The IBC Tax Strategy, I'm going to state on the front end that I think business owners are more apt to understand this explanation. But what I want to try to do is see if I can make my explanations fit both a person that is an employee as well as a business owner. And so how I would explain it would be this way. Bob used $1,000. Let's just use $10,000. And you need to pay for something or you want to buy something. And at the same time, you have a properly structured dividend paying whole life as well. So you've got $10,000 sitting in your checking account And then you also have an IBC policy that is, as I said, structured properly. And let's, instead of just saying we're going to purchase something or pay for something, let's use something that'll make us pay attention. Let's say that we're paying property taxes. Nobody likes to pay taxes. So once, if we can figure out a way to figure out how we can come ahead with our taxes, we have a tendency to really pay a little bit closer attention. Like, why don't we use taxes? Let's just say you're faced with having to pay your property tax bill, and it happens to be $10,000. So the question is, should I take out a policy loan and give that to the IRS, or the government? Or should I take the $10,000 that's sitting in my checking account and give that to the government? And I'm going to say that it makes sense to take out a policy loan rather than give them the $10,000 that's sitting in your checking account. And here's how I would explain it. I would ask you to consider how much money you had to make in order to wind up with $10,000 in your checking account. I don't know if you've ever thought about that, but you have to realize that that $10,000 that's in your checking account is the residual of money that you earned, and then you had to pay taxes on it. And then on top of that, you had to pay expenses on it before it reduced itself down to $10,000. And if you would just do a simple calculation on, you know, what is the money that I earned in order to wind up with $10,000? If I say to you that that $10,000 represents your discretionary income, the residual of what you wound up netting out after you paid taxes and paid expenses, and I say that that would represent 5% of that bigger number, and I'm using 5% because isn't that more or less what the savings rate for Americans, 5%? So 5% of, think about it, $200,000 is $10,000. So in other words, you had to work somewhere, or as a business owner, you had to sell stuff that came up to $200,000 in order for you to wind up finally with $10,000 in your checking account as the residual, as your profit or the savings that you're left with. So what is that differential? Well, it's 95% of the $200,000. It's made up in the taxes you paid and the expenses you paid in order to wind up with that number. And so I think to myself, you know, if I give the $10,000 to the government, I mean, I put a lot of blood, sweat, and tears into getting that $10,000. Is there a way to bypass all of that? Well, sure. If you have an IBC policy, you can, because when you get a policy loan, that money comes to you tax-free. The $10,000 just comes, you don't have to do all the extra labor. You don't have to generate $200,000 in order to get $10,000 from the life insurance company. You simply get the $10,000 already tax-free that you can just use tax-free. And that's what I would pay the government, you see. And then I would take that $10,000 very much in the same way that Bob was describing. I would take the $10,000 that is in my checking account, and I would put it into my PUA rider in my IBC policy. And the reason I would do that is because the way these things are calibrated, the fact that you're reinvesting your dividends and the fact that it goes into the PUA rider. Now, I can't say this across the board with all insurance companies, but you can more or less average that you will get for every dollar you put in, more or less $2. For every dollar that you put into that PUA rider plus the dividends that are being reinvested, you get somewhere near more or less $2. So if I put $10,000 in there, I'm going to get $20,000 in additional death benefit. So that $10,000 going into the policy is going to buy me $20,000 in additional death benefit. Now, why is that important to me? Because I now have a policy loan for $10,000 that at some point I'm going to pay back. And it has an interest rate on it. And I know as a business owner that as long as I pay that interest rate on that loan, I have the loan contained where it's not going to snowball. But that differential between what the loan is and what the death benefit is very important to me. And here's how. Because if I were to die right after I did that, after I put that $10,000 in and I got a $20,000 death benefit out of it, if I were to die right then, my wife, the beneficiary, would still get $10,000 because the life insurance company would simply subtract the policy loan of $10,000 from the $20,000 death benefit that I have. Now, that's just simply isolating that one move. And that's why it makes a big, big, big difference to me, is that I always have to think in terms of me dying at any, you know, at any given time. And I don't want to shortchange my spouse. So it's important for me to have a wide differential between the policy loans that I have and the death benefit that I have. Again, repeating what Bob says, you want to make sure you're always building up your policy because that's an ongoing thing. Now, that differential of that death benefit to the loans you have is so much different than when we're talking about the differential that we have, say, in the equity in our homes. It's not even close because the equity in our homes can collapse, whereas in the policy, they never collapse. I mean, it just continues to grow from there. And so you have an asset that's always growing there to buffer against whatever policy loans you do have. In addition to the fact that the terms on these policy loans are such, they're so flexible that you've heard us say before, I mean, the insurance company is not interested really when you're going to pay them back. You're not going to be getting a bill from them for the interest or the principal. So that's having that time, which is so important to business owners in particular, makes a big difference, you see. But yes, do I want to pay the loan back? Yes, I do. But the time affordability that it gives me helps me structure out my payments in such a way in the future that I can address that loan. And as Bob says, you pay off that loan, your cash value, you have more cash value used for more policy loans.
Yeah, so I got a few reactions to that, Carlos, just to, again, make sure everybody's fully absorbing and classifying this stuff properly. So it occurred to me as you were going through that, Carlos, that because I know, you know, you and I have talked about this offline, and you really are doing that. You're not just making up hypothetical examples.
Oh, absolutely.
This is stuff you're doing.
So
at the very least, folks, you can see that we're sincere. Maybe we're crazy, and maybe we're wrong, but at least we're doing this ourselves. We actually believe in this stuff. We're practicing what we preach. So one thing, just to make sure people aren't getting confused, if you had $10,000 in your checking account and then you're going to give that to the government for the property tax, it's not that you would have to then go earn $200,000 in business revenue to get that. That's a done deal. The question is, right now, what do I want to do? So it's, you know, you could just pay the $10,000, but the point being, if for some reason you just want to make sure you have a certain amount in your checking account for various reasons, so you had to go replenish that. So that, you know, in terms of going forward, I think what Carlos is saying is, in order for him then to, if he wanted to bulk up his checking account balance again, he would have to go out and, you know, it'd be a lot of hard work to put that $10,000 back in the checking account. And so that's where the issue comes in. And now, in fairness, if you borrowed against your policy and then you said, oh, and so now I want to come up with $10,000 next year to pay down the policy loan balance by 10 grand, you also would have to earn a lot with your business to do that. All right. So I think part of what's going on and why this really does make sense for you, Carlos, is that you've built yourself up. You know, you have a lot of available cash in your policy. And so you're, as you're saying, you know, you're looking at it as, well, no, I'm fine. You know, if I borrow the policy loan and then over time I just chip away at this thing, then, you know, I'm fine. If I die at any moment, it's great. I still have a huge net amount left there that even after paying off all of the outstanding policy loan balance, I still have a nice net death benefit that's going to go to my widow at that point. And the other clarification, I just want to make sure people understood, Carlos was saying in his experience, it seems that when he puts extra contributions into his policy, there's like a 2-for-1 effect. There, he's talking about the death benefit, right? So he's not saying he puts in $100 and then all of a sudden he's got $200 that he can borrow right back out. He's not saying that the available cash goes up 2-to-1. He was saying the death benefit does. So those are separate things. But the point is, especially, you know, for someone who's older and they know at some point in the not too distant future going to go, that's a really relevant consideration. That death benefit is a big asset. And the last thing I'll say on that, and this came up too with the original Twitter question, the guy said something like, I could see the pros and the cons of paying cash versus doing the IBC way, but, you know, if you already had as much life insurance as you wanted, you know, isn't IBC kind of an inefficient way to go about it? Like, it seems kind of convoluted to be buying more life insurance than I really want. And I'm not saying this particular individual was mistaken on this point, but let me just, you know, what I say to people when they ask stuff like that is I say, well, are you planning on having any assets in your estate when you die? In other words, are you planning on having an estate where you give things to people, you know, upon your death? And just about everybody says, oh yeah, of course I am. And so again, that's, you know, you can do it in the form of a life insurance, but that's a very easy way. And there's certain tax advantages with the changes in the estate tax laws. It's not as big a deal now as it used to be, but still it's a very convenient, simple way to transfer wealth, you know, to your designated beneficiaries after you die. And so, in other words, instead of saying, well, gee, I don't need more life insurance, why don't I bulk up my, how much I have in the stock market or whatever? Say, okay, well, why do you want to do that? Well, because when I die, I want to have a bunch of money left to my estate. Well, okay. So you can have that in the form of, so that's what I'm getting at, that it's, you don't need to merely think, well, gee, you know, I don't have a wife and kids that I'm supporting, so why do I need life insurance? That's not really the right way to think about it. If you are someone who plans on having money left to your estate, you know, when you die, that's one of the functions of a life insurance policy, is that's a good way to facilitate that intergenerational transfer of wealth.
Plus, Bob, in addition to that, is that, and it's one of the reasons in the book that we wrote, The Case for IBC, we're advising people to set up their own alternate bank, you know, using a dividend-paying whole life insurance policy because of the problems that we see in banks, in doing business with banks. So in addition to having an estate or that kind of thing, or a lot of life insurance, it's this whole idea that we're using the dividend-paying whole life policy as a cash flow system, because it'll mimic all of the services that a commercial bank will provide, except it's a much better and safer place to have the money, okay? The reason so many Americans are in debt is because they never are able to save any money, but they want to buy things, but they don't have the cash for it. And so they wind up borrowing the money using either credit cards or financing companies or whatever. And, you know, they just wind up increasing their debt load that way. And those are the worst places to borrow from because the terms on those things are terrible. And so it's not just so much about building up a life insurance policy for an estate basis or a life-death benefit. It's this whole idea is that it's a better cash flow system, safer cash flow system, than the commercial banking cash flow system, which is really what that is too. So the whole idea is that it's trying to encourage you that you should make every attempt to get one of these policies set up for yourself so that you can see some of the benefits that are there. It's not so much about taking out policy loans and, you know, having a lot of loans with a life insurance company necessarily, but if you're going to take out an IBC policy to do this sort of thing, you are going to wind up taking policy loans because you're going to have things that you're going to want to buy. And a lot of these things that you want to buy are just, you know, things in life. You know, you're going to pay for a wedding, or you're going to repair a house, you're going to buy a new car because the old one broke down. You know, you'll find that you don't have the money and you're going to wind up borrowing it somewhere. And so by borrowing it from the life insurance company, you stand a much better chance of being able to get ahead than if you keep doing it under the system of using commercial banks and then credit cards and financing companies to purchase your things.
Yeah, and I think that's probably a good spot for us to wrap up this one. Obviously, folks, we can only chip away at all these questions, and any particular episode is not going to answer all of your doubts and concerns. So we'd point you to the book that we wrote with Nelson Nash called The Case for IBC. It's at thecaseforibc.com. Also, obviously, if you haven't read it, you want to check out Nash's original book, Becoming Your Own Banker, which laid out what IBC was and how to use it. And also remember, if you are able to get to the Fort Worth area on October 13th, 2018, we will be there along with David Stearns. And so go to ibcseminar.com for that. Other than that, we will see you next episode. Thanks, everybody.
You've just finished another episode of The Laura Murphy Show. Be sure to share this podcast with your friends and colleagues to do your part in building the 10%.
The Laura Murphy Show is provided with the understanding that the staff and contributors of LauraMurphy.com are not here and engaged in rendering legal, accounting, tax, or investment advice. On such matters, please consult your own professional tax, legal, or financial advisor.